Good evening and welcome. I did something I don't usually do, which is jot down some notes in the hopes that if I can't spark some sort of spirit tonight, at least it may keep me from wandering off into some kind of random dreariness with you, if I can read them. First of all, I want to thank Norman, who very sweetly gave up his opportunity to address you tonight so that he could come to my talk. And I'm very, very happy to see him here. First of all, I'm delighted that this it gives me a chance to say hello to all of you in a formal setting and context. Some of you, you know, we have histories that go way back. Some of you, just a short time, and some of you are just new faces, vice versa. So maybe this is, although I did know this was going to happen so soon, I'm very happy to have the opportunity tonight to meet with you. So, I was just thinking, when I left Asahara, I gave a little talk, a goodbye monk's talk there. And in that, somebody asked me, well, you've been Daigon down here for these last years, what are you going to be up in Green Gulch? And I said, maybe I'll just be Old Dave. And Old Dave is actually from a limerick. And, of course, I'm going to tell you what the limerick is so that you get a picture of what this character is aiming at. There was an old monk named Dave who sat all day in his cave. But at night, he came out, began to dance and shout, and in general, misbehave. I'm beginning to enjoy becoming a garrulous old man, and maybe tonight will be my initial opportunity. Well, Arlene and I have returned from the mountain to the sea, from the very craggy escarpments and deep, sharp canyons and dry weather of Tasahara to the salubrious breezes of the ocean at Muir Beach. It's very interesting to come back for me. It's been a number of years since I have been here, lived here, and it's like coming home in a way, and the home is new. Both places, I think, Tasahara and Green Gulch, both the mountain and the sea, at least in my experience, are places that I come to, maybe we come to be cured of our afflictions or healed of our wounds. Or if we're lucky, maybe cleansed of our grievous habits and infuriating and nauseating tendency to substantiate and reify everything. The Tasahara is talking to Tommy Nason. Tommy Nason, as many of you know, is a Native American. And we're talking about how when one comes to Tasahara and it's more extreme, wets and colds and so on, and dries, very elemental place and a very traditionally a healing place because of the hot springs, a power place. But that one comes there as a guest, as a camper, as a visitor. One doesn't come to put down one's permanent roots. It's a place that we go to be restored. And I feel both places have that that powerful force, attraction. And not only do we come to get cured and healed of our afflicted ways, but to do it together in a sangha with goodwill and with the very purpose of studying this question of what our lives mean to us. Actually, this talk, I'll tell you right now, this talk is about Gate Gate Para Gate Para Sam Gate Bodhisattva. It's about emptiness. I told Norman I would talk about emptiness. It's not about emptiness. But it will be cunningly concealed, even to myself, especially to myself. And furthermore, you know, over the years I've gone back and forth and actually left a couple of times, and the kind of rhythm gets established there. And if you stay long enough, that rhythm can become very important part of your life to see how we're two-handed, two-sided people. Actually, we use our hands and to realize that the two-sidedness comes together as one. One side, you know, is kind of outward, you know, and extroverted. And that tendency in that particular sociolinguistic convention of a self. And we like to call those people, you know, that side of ourselves worldly and engaged in the dance of life. And totally throw ourselves into it, into the game of it, and become, you know, totally distracted in some sense. And so that we can lose ourselves, forget ourselves, involve ourselves deeply into something. I think under all of this, parenthetically, that what all of us want to do is to experience our lives deeply and profoundly. And life just leading a life of life, but in a way that we feel intensely, to be felt, a way of being in the world that is deeply felt. The other side, when that gets to be too much, sends us hurrying to the ocean or to the mountains, to some sort of retreat, to some sort of place that we can find solace and even consolation. And even a kind of ascetic way in which all of our possessions we can shed and drop and become very light again and feel free in that dimension of ourselves. And then after we've sat in the mountains of Tassajara and the rain has been leaking down your neck and you forget just how wet the rain can be when you have to work in it when it's cold. And you haven't had chocolate in 6 weeks. I can mention some of the other amenities. And you wonder why you ever did this, why you ever got involved in this. And you begin to dream of the other aspects, the other side of your life, the involved side. Why didn't I make something? Why didn't I go back to school? Why didn't I do this, do that? That kind of mind comes up, pulses back and forth. This is the rhythm I've noticed in myself. I've noticed in a lot of people that most of my friends and acquaintances over the years have this rhythm, and frankly, I believe it's part of the path to do this. The pathless path of going back and forth. It's a rhythm that of opening and closing, of shedding and acquiring, and I think personally, in my own practice, the practice of observing that process is very freeing, very liberating. I think so because not to try to control, not to be, you know, totally worldly, not to be Charles Bukowski all the time, or the Marquis de Sade, or a movie star, or somebody who has a public persona that is deeply invested in and defended. Not necessarily be a saint, you know, or an ascetic, you know, totally shedding. Where do you draw the line with that? but full-bodied in both ways. So in my case, it's very interesting that I find myself painting walls again after 15 or 18 years of no domesticity in my life. And to be engaged in those household tasks that I thought for sure I had left behind. Of course, you know, I say, you know, to live our life, to feel that one in this rhythm, in this motion, in this flow, and studying the flow at the same time is is not a cool way for Zen to be. Zen plays it cool, and there's no exaggeration and no diminishing in Zen. We're just very cool about the raging inferno within ourselves and the world. That's our style, to do it that way, not to make a big deal out of anything, including not making a big deal about it. Of course, I think I have to say that my experience in living in Sangha for all these years is that we make a big deal about it. I make a big deal about it all the time. But as I said before, I think we come here to be cleansed. And another way of saying it, the self-clinging of this reifying, the substantiating tendency we have about hanging on to some ultimate in our life. to be undone of all that affair once and for all. In other words, to come already in peace. To come already surrendered. To come already abandoned of both fear and hope. And then to do that over and over. Each moment, each time. Come already in peace. Already surrendered. Already given up that you're going to be able to hang on to any aspect of it whatsoever, including the story I'm telling you right now. And then, of course, the practice is to learn to dance with that rhythm, in my experience. That's actually what I mean, but what I think one translation of gate, parasam, gate, bodhisvaha is just that. Already in peace with the conventional duality that we live in. Already seeing through that aspect, that image of clinging to that. Already abandoned of any hope of getting anything out of it except whatever is arising as the condition or state of mind at the moment. If I were a Christian, I would say, is that or is that not the divine event? Right there, right now. And how to live that from moment to moment. And to thank the world for whatever comes at you in this dance. That's a hard practice. To thank it and to rejoice in it. But I think as I've gotten older, it's become easier to do that. Maybe because there's less time to do it. Maybe if someone held a gun to our heads right now tonight and told us by dawn tomorrow none of us would be here, maybe right now we would, if we were lucky and could drop a dance in this moment, maybe. But every time I talk like this and I see everybody's face and it looks very serious. And one of the things I would like to overcome is any too serious tendency we have around any of this business that we're doing. And that doesn't mean not to treat it seriously. A little different from taking it seriously. Hanging on to it. Treating it with respect. Everything that way. But don't take it seriously. Don't make it into something. I think that's what the Prajnaparamita Sutras is about, very profound. The only ultimate is that there is no ultimate with this. Then the question, of course, as you all know and have heard many times, is how to live it. But has any of you who have ever taken creative writing courses know? The first thing you learn that a good story has to have conflict in it. It has to have struggle. It has to have some idea of time and attainment. Something to overcome. There's a self to overcome, a world that's out there. I love it. I like to read it. I like to watch it in the movies. I like to watch it in my own life. Don't you?
It's somebody else.
Sometimes I don't like it so well. I wish there was somebody else watching it. But I don't think that to be what I have said to be, to come already in peace means you're carrying a peace sign in your head or on your. But it's to come fully abandoned to whatever comes up. The bayonet, the bomb, the tank, the friend, the foe, all those dualities, boom, you meet them right there. And that's what Soto Zen practice is about, meeting it right there and doing it in a community of friends with lots of rituals and ceremonies to point to the fact that that's what we're doing all the time anyway. Just ritualize our life a little bit to appreciate it. Anyway, to come back to Green Gulch again and to feel the ground under my feet, I took a walk for the first time to the ocean in 2 weeks since I've been here. Made it down to the ocean. So the change at Mir Beach, it's shifted. New signs, new walkways, you can walk here, you can't walk, everything's changed again. You come here and everything opens up, you feel like you want to do this. The heels are all nice and round. You see a lot of sun in there. But it's very cozy, very purifying, but you know you're a guest out there, you know, for sure. Here you can get lulled into a fact that maybe you can slip by, and, you know, but down there you can't slip by. It's easy. Well, maybe when the typhoons and stuff come in this winter, we won't feel that way right now. Anyway, what I'm interested in is this practice with you, and I really just wanted to use a few minutes tonight to say a few words, and you know, for you to look at me, and for me to taste my foot in my mouth again. And it's the first time I've ever, in the years of Green Gulch, have come here in robes to give a talk. So it's the first time for me too tonight to do something like that. And I'm grateful for the opportunity with you. Well, does anyone have any questions you'd like to ask? A little discussion? Maybe to keep you awake for... What time is it over, by the way?
Huh?
I take it from the response, Martin, that that's not exactly the case.
It's about 8:30.
8:30. As soon as we get into a discussion of self-clinging, we get into a discussion of strategies. As soon as we get into strategies, well, we have to get into strategies, but we give what does Shakespeare say? Give to airy nothingness a local habitation and a name. The name of the game is the game of the name. I hope somebody asks a question.
I was going to ask you a strategy question.
A strategy question.
And I was, as you were speaking, I was wondering what I can feel all the wrong things I'm saying in this question, but anyway, just what you feel has supported you the most or helped you the most in this practice, because we do have these habits that are so tenacious, I would say.
Everything helps. Everything helps in the practice. Everything. It's really true. Everything, you know, the more one opens up, the more everything comes forward to confirm all your neuroses. And anyway, your story. Whatever you want it to be. And it's not so much of trying to get through that for me anyway, it's how to play with it more. How to enjoy it. Whatever it is. If that's my strategy. But that's more like a heart feeling than a strategy. It just feels natural to want to do it that way for me tonight.
Diane?
Yes?
I remember reading in the Majjhima Nikaya somewhere about Buddha's life story when he goes to sit underneath the tree. And at other points in his life, he chose beautiful spots that he thought were conducive to meditation, calming his mind. Talks about the beauty of the forest he's in. And I'm just wondering, Sun's question about what helps us to practice. Like, is there a place for... Is there a place for kind of creating an environment that is easier for you to practice in? You know, if you like something, if a certain posture or something helps you to... We don't struggle so much. If it's kind of like enough struggle, but not too much. Is that okay?
Well, I mean, isn't the point more to be at home in the world wherever you are, under whatever condition?
Yeah, but for...
For learning how to do that?
Yeah.
Is there a... Well, that's what I'm saying. You got two choices. You go back and forth between two choices, between, you know, kind of pulling back and withdrawing and becoming internalized more and looking at the whole process, you know, or throwing yourself into the maelstrom again, but with some awareness of what you're doing, more awareness that way, going back and forth. Our minds are doing that all the time. You know, I think it's in our nervous system. Two-handed person. So the more, for me, I would think the question would be more, how to, you know, for strategy, how to make the opportunity out of whatever's coming up. Can't control that anyway. Except in your habit energy, the way you respond to the forces of your experience. Right there is the time to do it. Next time you get really angry, that's the time to study your anger. Right then. Not while you're watching the sunset, you know. And that's my experience.
Diane, why does it kind of arise so often, and it certainly does in me, to want to be inspired? What is that primal need, and how do you practice with that when you come out of a talk and you feel inspired, or you come out of a talk and you feel bored? And, what is that constantly?
Well, you're a fire person. See? You're a Sagittarian with Mars conjunct, so you got a lot of... You just got to be out there, you know. A lot of people are water people. They don't want to be out there at all. They just want it, you know. They want to draw other people to them. So on. But inspiration, that's a valid question. What is inspiration? To inspire to take in breath, to breathe afresh, anew, get a new breath. Wow, it's like a new breath. That person, that place, that thing is a new breath, you know. That's inspiration. It's literally inspiration. So somebody, words do that to us, you know. The trouble is they don't really inspire us. We then immediately laminate them and put them in our wallet as something to live. Well, I do that. What?
That's why they call it the discovery card.
Well, you know, to be undone, I wrote down here, is to be well done. Cooked through and through. That's an old image, isn't it? You know, or the plum falling to the ground, the fruit that gets really ripe, you know. Or unsui, the cloud and water, the It's very fluid, isn't it? We're trying to get, soften up and get really fluid, not so obstructed, you know, and just always a little bit angry.
Dagan,
yeah.
Doesn't the plum squelch when it hits the ground?
Well, yeah, well, maybe I got the wrong fruit. I mean, whatever, fine, it just falls apart. Right? Well, yes, Martha.
I've been reading quite a wonderful book by Les Kay called Zen at Work. And he has a quote from Suzuki Roshi that reminds me somewhat of what you're saying, which is that what we're doing is much too important to be taken seriously.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And that's certainly something I would love to have say more about, because I see in myself a tendency to take things, to feel a kind of sadness for the world, to see the pain, and then to take it all, you know, quite seriously, take myself seriously in it. And I'm
glad you said sadness, you know, because in the world we live in the world of impermanence, sadness is a very basic feeling in the human psyche, I think, maybe a lot of animals. So someplace in one of his lectures, I remember Trungpa Rinpoche talked about sadness as part of a big part of the Bodhisattva's heart, to feel the sadness of the fleeting world, of all things. But how to take that with a light heart is what your question is. Well, only really serious people want to ask that question to begin with anyway, right? It's a very serious question. So the dice are a little bit loaded right from the start. I don't know. How to take ourselves lightly here, you know. I heard, what's that old saying? Angels take things, the reason angels can fly is because they take themselves lightly. Mm-hmm. You've heard that, right? But how is another strategy question. And I think it's just a matter of maybe wearing down a little bit. And without surrendering in the sense of just, I give up, but surrendering in the sense of, I rejoice, and whatever the occasion is, even if it's sorrow. I mean, who else is going to have that but you and me? You, your way, which I'll never know. I could be sad about that. You'll never know exactly how it is for me. Ever. Or any of us here. We just have the common condition which we describe in stories like tonight. Something sad in that. I mean, there's a whole array of new faces tonight that will be gone, you know, before you can say Jack Robinson. I mean, we have two choices, how to take that kind of situation, you know. You know? Knock on the door when everybody leaves at Tassajara, or your friends go, you knock on the door, it sounds hollow, right? You drink tea, it tastes flat. Life goes, Now we're a poet, you know, eat your fine words. How do you feel? That's the point, you know, which we all get to, I think. We have to see that also that has no more essence than anything else.
I've known you for some time, and I remember some times in your life which were quite sad.
Oh, not
and
me.
And out of that time, out of that period in your life came some of the most beautiful poetry. So when I saw you as you got older getting happier, I knew there would be less poetry.
Oh, but more dancing. More dancing. Well, it's true, you know, one of those romantic types.
Yeah.
That have to hit the depths to get inspired and just scribble. When I'm just flowing in the day-to-day conventional way without too much stress, I don't feel inspired to put it in words. I'm not a real poet in that sense.
You're okay with me?
But some poet I read recently said it was used the word to celebrate the pain, the calm, and the astonishment. Mm-hmm. So just to hear, just to let the world arise, you know, as the five skandhas, and to rejoice in its conflict and in our stories and so on, agate, you know, and then to see through that, gate, paragate, to even let that one go, and parasamgate, you're just back right here, lost or found as you ever were, but different, happy. Perfectly yourself. That stomach, bald head. Got a Mickey Mouse watch. I did. I bought a Mickey Mouse watch. I saw it. We walked into a clock store to buy a clock for the kitchen. I came out somehow with a Mickey Mouse watch.
You always wanted one.
Yeah, but I was too embarrassed to wear it when I was younger. Maybe we're drifting here a little bit. I am. Any more questions?
You once told me that in the summer of Tazahara that for you, this teaching, if it is a teaching, is about learning to continually open your heart right to the end. So that as you die, you're more open than you've ever been. And I wonder how that's been for you.
It's been wonderful when it's been open, and it's been awful when it's not. And when I close it, and sometimes even deliberately. Sometimes I have deliberately closed my heart. There's a point, you know, on which it's too painful. Oh, you don't think I'm sitting here because I know that, you know, I know the part of the closed heart. So how much I got heart trouble. I think it comes from that. Somewhere it's closed. A little heart trouble. Anyway, I think just doing a practice together with other people and running into one another all the time. It's very embarrassing, but it's necessary. So that's the only way you will open your heart. Of course, I open my heart tonight to this gorgeous, you know, picturesque sunset. This wonderful seascape and skyscapes you get here. And Mira Beach, like, phenomenal stuff. I sit there, you know, see that golden glow flow through here at sundown and so on. I think, wow, you know. But at other times, that's when I feel the contraction. That's when I'm very sensitive. You know, you sit, we all are, you really feel the egoic contraction. I mean, you know, the limbic system kicking, whatever it is. Cool. Either this or this, or some movement away from your steady point. And all the teaching, Reb and everybody's always been telling the whole practice of the sotos in practice is what to sit up right in the midst of whatever's arising. You know, that's having an open, at least having the chance for an open heart to be already undefended, as I said before. But I don't think you can make it happen other than just make yourself available to something, which is Zazen and following schedules and living with people. And because it is a dynamic process, and because it's always a revelation, it's a surprise, and it's often a painful one. It's an insult. And somebody said, living like this is an insult to the ego, and it is. But that's where the movie is at the same time, and so you can't get all the movie. Nor do we want to. I don't think we want to, really. Although there have been a lot of people who said, beam me up, Captain Kirk. By that enough, including a lot of the Indian and the philosophies in the subcontinent. This is not a happy place to be. In the West, well, especially middle-class white America. It's the dominion of God given us, you know, as a covenant to take care of and so on. Quite a different thing, but we have to come at it from a little different angle to take care of the covenant, the land, the resources and everything. not to exploit them. So we have you know, they let all that go, and because they're otherworldly already, we're so worldly, but we get in this, you know, more Eastern mode and see that the world is a wonderful place to live, and I don't want Captain Kirk to beam me up from this blue jewel in the blackness. Anybody else? Anyway, I'm very, very happy that you came tonight, and you know, just I listen to talks like I listen to wind in the trees or something too. That's how you're supposed to listen to these talks until. It's a good idea. You know, it's just conventional linguistic storytelling. That's a good start.